MTN and MS&B were in one building. The transmission plant, which makes gearboxes, was on the same site but in a separate building with its own security fence. In terms of the union, it had its own shop stewards committee and its own trade union branch. MS&B and PTA had shared the one union branch, but they had two separate shop stewards committees. And like Carlos talked about the size of the branch, I was in the TNG. There were 7,000 members in our branch. And in all the time, apart from one meeting, I never seen more than 25 people at a union branch meeting, and that included the seven members of the branch committee. The union branch system just didn't attract people. Now, it was a greenfield factory. They wouldn't recruit anybody under the age of 20. They wanted people between roughly the age of 20 and 40 who were married with commitments. If you come off the docks, the building sites of the Merchant Navy, you weren't really welcome. They took on 14% of the were unemployed, but the rest had all been in work. But none of them had worked in factories. They didn't want people who'd worked in factories. Obviously, they thought they'd have some experience in unions. I mean, they didn't block the unions in, but the unions had to fight in there to have a presence and to have organisation. But it backfired because green labour turned into very militant labour. It's just like, you know anything about the Fiat system? The Mirafiori factory in Turin was described by Gianni Agnelli, who owned Fiat, as the ungovernable factory. And they must have been a bit better than us, because we didn't get slagged off that much. We got called, what was it, the basket case of the Ford Motor Company. And then there was an article in The Economist said that we were the worst car workers in the world. Well, we never got the medals for it, but we thought we should have done. Right, so they wanted these married men, but you had a huge turnover of labour, and that is unusual. In Dagenham in the late 70s, there was 20% of some of the plants leaving per month. They just wouldn't work there. Now, in Liverpool, heavy unemployment always. Fords was that bad, people were just leaving in droves, right? In, where is it? I've got it somewhere. Labour turnover, right? In 1966, 1,140 workers left the PTA out of a total of 3,200. So we're talking nearly 50% just wouldn't take it in a time of high unemployment. In 69, it had gone up to 1,800 out of the PTA leaving. Because what they did, they brought a load of, there's no experience up to that point on Merseyside of building cars. So they brought the supervision up from Dagenham. And because of the militancy in Dagenham over the 50s and the 60s, they were determined that it wasn't going to happen in Halewood. So these people come with a plan to keep us in line. Well, I wasn't there, and I didn't start at 70. But that was their attitude. We shout, you jump on the shovel. It backfired because, well, we don't like doing things like that.
Was that 50% turnover a month?
That was 66, it was in a year. But that's a hell of a lot of people to leave a factory in an unemployment hotspot. So the relationship with the unions, I'd like to look at. Right? In Ford's, when you're negotiating your wage deal and stuff, it's the National Joint Negotiation Committee. And in the 60s, there were 18 union reps on the NJNC. Every one of them was a full-time union official. There was no input from the shop floor. He's touched on similar stuff. Right. The 69 strike was a big strike, and it changed that. It was a watershed, if you like. After that, four conveners went on to the joint, onto the National Joint Negotiation Committee. And in a sense, it was a gain, but it was also a loss, I think, because what started to happen, because they weren't on it originally, there was that antagonism between the rank and file and the full timers. Once you got the conveners on that committee, they started to be sucked in to the system and they became part of the problem, as I see it. Right. All the unions had a vote on the NJNC, but if you look at the figures for... So, there was 18 votes. There were 16 unions at this point, but two... The engineers and the electricians had both made amalgamations with other unions, so they still had two votes. They were counted as... So you had 18 votes, equal votes. There was no weighting involved. This is from 69. Transport and General Workers Union had, across the whole of Ford's Britain, 17,500 members. If you go to the National Society of Metal Mechanics, they had under 100. And in fact, there was... 11 unions with under 250 members. They could vote through recommendations to accept the wage offers. But the bigger unions were the unions that represented the line workers. All the conveners were either, across the country, were either TNG or AEF, the engineering union. But there was no representation on that committee until after the 69 strike, because the union officials did deals, recommended an acceptance of a wage offer. Halewood just walked, it wasn't having it, and it resulted in one union official basically being sacked. Halewood decided to win, having nothing to do with him, so he was driven out, and another guy resigned. But then the conveners, as I say, got sucked into that system, and they'd be in London for meetings when they should have been on the factory floor. And the distance started to develop at that point, I think, and the shop stewards committee started to become a police force, cracking down on wildcat strikes, unofficial actions of various sorts. For example, you're on the Tower Hill rent strike, which Carlos has referred to. They jailed people at the end of the, towards the end of that strike. There was people jailed for not paying the rent, and it had some commitment off the Ford's branch at Halewood that if anyone was jailed, there would be support given. They came to me. I was in the International Socialist at the time, and some of the people in the rent strike were International Socialists. That's the forerunner of the Socialist Worker Party. I take the tablets now, so I don't actually. I'm all right. Okay. Except when there's a full moon.
Apologise for any members of it.
I don't actually. I try not to be sectarian, but I have to admit I am over the SWP. After the way. Well, I won't go into that. Right, where was it? Right, so I was approached by two people from the Tower Hill rent strike. I said, look, there's four people just been jailed. We've been promised support. We just had a branch meeting, so we would have had to wait another 3 weeks or so. So I got these two guys in. I smuggled them into the factory, because I'd get sacked out. So I told them where to stand, wear clothes, don't speak to me. Even my mate had driven me to work, he didn't even know anything about it. I took him into the plant, he just followed me in. I took him to the union office, said who'd he were. The convener was at an NJNC in London, there was a deputy convener, three of the union officials. They introduced him, said I've got to go to work. At 2 o'clock I was all up before managing personnel for bringing two unauthorised people into the factory. The only four people in that factory knew, my own shop steward, deputy convener, branch chairman and another shop steward. And then they refused to talk to me when I raised the issue. I denied it and the company couldn't prove it because they didn't have the two guys, they hadn't been stopped, and the union would have had to put its hand up and say, we grassed them, and they wouldn't do that. So that's what started to happen in the 70s. You're actually not just having to fight the full-timers, we're having to fight the shop stewards and especially the senior stewards. In the 60s, it was different. there was some young stewards who were fighting the system. They were fighting the full-timers and they were fighting the company. But the three main guys in that, the three guys with most energy and the most political nous, over a period of about 3 years, all got made full-time union officials. And then after the that we had what was known as the Heighton Mafia. Heighton is an area on the outskirts of Liverpool, and they were all in the Heighton Labour Party, and they held three of the senior positions within the Shop Stewards Committee within the PTA. The MS&B was different. The MS&B wasn't into the union as much as the PTA. The PTA policy amongst the stewards was to get into the union positions, various committees, national committees, local committees, finance and general purposes committee, for example, the local district committee, to win positions there so we could have put some pressure on. But the MS&B's attitude was they weren't bothered, they were just interested in what was going on in the factory. And in fact, the branch committee out of seven members, five of them, or six sometimes, were from the PTA. The MS&B just didn't really bother with that stuff. But in 71, we had a strike which lasted 9 weeks right across the country. I can't speak for Dagenham, but it was solid. We didn't have anyone crossing the picket lines, and we were out solid. It was broken by the union after 9 weeks, and it was broken by a man who's regarded as a hero of the trade union movement, and in some ways he was, Jack Jones, who fought in the Spanish Civil War. But being a hero doesn't make you right all the time. And in 71, he and Hugh Scanlon decided to end our dispute. And you can look at reasons. The union was paying out a lot of money and its funds were dwindling, but they imposed a secret ballot on us in 71, way before any government was proposing to do that. And it nearly destroyed Harewood in terms of workers' organisation, because they didn't consult. They decided that's what it was. They didn't refer to mass meetings, because at Harewood, we had a lot of mass meetings. A lot of leafleting went on before that dispute, 71. Always report back meetings, regular report, to keep everybody on the shop floor informed. And then big mass meetings in the boxing stadium. That didn't happen. A ballot, some vote, hardly anyone in Aylward did. I think it was about 33% took part in the ballot, and of them it was almost a 50-50 split to accept. We were back out again shortly. But the ballot said go back to work of those who did vote, and the union was saying you've got to go back. We've struck a deal with the company, we have to keep our word, it's a matter of honour. We were forced back, and then we were out again in Aylward. I think some people in Dagenham also came out at that time. But then we were driven back again. The full-time union officials, Moss Evans, went to Dagenham. Swansea came out as well. He went to Swansea and he came to Harewood and said, look, we've got to go back. We've done the deal. So we went back very angry. And the company had meetings just prior to this. And they decided we were putting the steel toe caps on. They called all the foremen in and instructed them, this is what you've got to do. Kick the crap out of them. They were going to reimpose their discipline on the workforce. And we all gathered round. It's like if I'm the foreman, you should all be there, and I'll be saying, you can't leave the line unless you've got an official right to go. You're the shop steward, you don't leave the line until I give you permission. Because we used to go off and do things, you know. If there was gaps, you go over and see your mates, someone else. They cracked down, absolutely. It was by the rule book. Guys were getting suspended, 1 day, 2 day, 3 day suspensions. Some got sacked. The shop stewards committee were saying, hold the line, hold it. We're not going on strike. We were saying, out, we want to go out. Can't have this happening. Good men are being sacked for going to the toilet. They have a toilet relief, need to go to the toilet again. Can't go. So they go. The foreman said, you haven't got permission. You're suspended. And I say some got sacked, and then they sacked the shop steward, John Dillon, in the paint shop. John Dillon was a member of the Socialist Labour League, which later became the Workers' Revolutionary Party. He was persuaded to go to a meeting with management. The guy stormed the office. There was certain amounts of aggression, threats. But they picked on him. They said he'd led it, but he'd actually been more or less pulled there by the guys. So he got sacked. And we went on strike. Now, I don't think they were going to defend the union called the shop stewards committee call us out. I don't think they were doing that because it was John Dillon. John Dillon was a Trotskyist, and the Haydn Mafia don't like Trotskyists, so. But it was because he was a shop steward, and they realised that if they get in, they'll come for us next. So we were out for the week, he got reinstated, but the deal was that he'd never be a shop steward again. And then he moved him out of his area in the paint shop and took him to the garage area, which is a completely different area in terms of attitude to the workers. It's a much easier area to work than in the paint shops. He got sacked a few years later for having a fight with a shop steward. Shop steward got a one-day suspension. He got the sack. The union, the shop steward's committee said, tough. He shouldn't have been fighting. He said, but he was fighting as well. Said, tough, you're gone. That was in the PCA, right? There was a campaign raised in the body shop. There was a guy in the WRP working in the body shop, and they got a petition up, got 2,000 signatures. I took the petition up in the PTA, I was a steward by then. I got 200 signatures, and I forced Moss Evans to hold an inquiry into what happened. And they had an inquiry, and they set a full-timer in, but John Dillon stayed sacked. His own plant wouldn't back him. The shop stewards wouldn't back him, therefore the guys didn't back him. And the man was thrown out of work. He was married with children. That didn't count at all. That's what happened in the PTA. In the 70s, it became the enemy for a lot of us on the lines. In the 60s, it had been the most militant plant in Halewood. In the 70s, it became the MS&B, which became the most militant plant, because it didn't have the same control over it of the senior stewards. They had more movement within the shop stewards committee in terms of people getting voted out, people packing in. So they couldn't exercise that much control on the rank and file. And you had, during the 70s, a whole series of wildcat strikes in the body plant over all sorts of stuff. Don't see. Stuff like that, but also health and safety issues. There's a line, a part of the body plant's known as the body in white because that's the complete car, but it hasn't been painted or fitted out. And next to it's the lead boots, and when you work in a lead boot, you're dressed like a spaceman because lead's a very, very dangerous metal. They had issues around lead levels, and they would walk at the drop of a hat. Eventually, they sent in a man from the health and safety executive to look at the issue. And the lads thought, well, no, he might find in our favour, but he might not. So let's shorten the odds a bit. So they had a collection on the lines and they tried to bribe them. They raised a couple of £100, right? He was absolutely affronted. And he found in favour of the company, so it does it backfire. But, and I'll tell you a little anecdote really. We had a week, we were on nights, and they walked. The lead boots, they just walked. So we got laid off for about 12:30 at night. Go home. Come in the next night, they walked. At 12 o'clock, we get laid off. Come in the third night, they go at 11:30, we get laid off. So I don't drive, but getting driven home, me and my mate, and he said, they're going to go tomorrow. I said, no, they're going to go. He said, well, if we get laid off at 11:30, we jump in the car, we shoot to town, we go to a club and have a few drinks, because you can't sleep when you've been asleep all day. So we can't go in our wear clothes. He said, we'll bring gear in. So we brought our best gear in, like, because he bags in, hang them up on the line. The bastards worked, they never went on strike. There's our best suits hanging there. The lads, but, no, they took some stick over that one. Now, that was the 70s. If you look at the, I'm now going to look at a period when I never worked there, because what. The main point I'm going to try and I want to make really is how Ford's, as an organisation, the workers' organisation, a strong militant plant in Halewood, same in Dagenham. If you look at it now, you wouldn't recognise it. And when did you last hear of a dispute in Ford's?
Visited.
this team. Right. From 1980, they started to try and implement Japanese ways of working. Forge was a measured day system. That is, they timed the jobs. They timed them in hundreds of a minute, actually, to get a more accurate reading. And they said it was a science. The only science it was bullshit science. And they admitted a 5% error was possible. So if you had a job over 57 minutes, it was feasible. That's 57 minutes in the hour. It's feasible that it could be over an hour, because you had 5% of an hour is 3 minutes. And there were constant battles over work allocations, over times. And they would always be seeking to retime, sort of on some weak excuse, or to take a man out. And what they'd do is say, well, on the other shift, we've got 25 men, and we've got 26 on this section, so we take a man out. You won't miss it, because we'll spread the work out amongst the 25, and it'll be the same as the other shift. So I used to say, well, we got 26 and they got 25. Yeah? I said, well, why don't you give them an extra man? And then we both had 26. And but you never ever agree to that. But, anyway, come the 80s, they started to involve technology, more and more technology, trying to remove the need for workers. And they started to look at the Japanese way of working. They've been looking at it for a long time, actually. Some of the reading I've been doing, they were obviously thinking about it in the 60s, because they were using the language of Japan then. Continuous improvements, they wanted to impose a system that meant we would continually work harder. And what you started to see then in the 80s was a reduction in the workforce right across Britain. So from 1980, they were employing, in total, in the UK, 76,000 people. By 84, it was down to 57,000, right? And in Halewood, these days, there's 2,000. And the transmission plant is owned by Ford's and a company called Getrag, which is a German company. They employ 690 workers. The body, the MS&B and the PTA are owned by Tata, an Indian company. The factory was converted to Jaguar by Ford's, and they sold Jaguar to Tata. So that's the name of the company that owns it, and they have 2,000 workers. They're taking on 1,000 extra workers very shortly to work on the new Land Rover, and possibly another 500 on top of that. So that's a big take-on when you consider 2,000. But what they're doing, they're not taking them on. They're taking manpower. The employment agency is going to employ these 1,000 workers and put them into Ford's. And they're on something like 10% less in wages than the workers at that. I keep calling it Ford's. That's Jaguar. There's a possibility they'll get a wage rise in 2 years. There's a possibility some of them might get made permanent in a couple of years' time. So, Halewood had 14,000 when I worked there. It's now down to 2,000. Some of them are agency workers already. And now they're going to bring more agency workers in. So the composition of that factory has changed radically. You know, and we talk about the stuff that went on. The wildcats, the big strikes, the way we were all tight on the picket line. And I think today, if we're to understand how to fight capital today, we have to understand, to use Marxist term, how labour power is organised today. So if you look at Ford's Halewood then and now, you can start to see the problems that exist now and maybe try and find ways of overcoming it. In the 70s, 65% of the car was built in the factory. In supply chain terminology these days, Halewood is an original equipment manufacturer. In Japan, 35% of the car in the 70s was built in the original equipment manufacturer. 65% was built outside in by suppliers. Ford's intention, and they succeeded in, through the Jaguar process, turned Halewood over. And now Halewood produces 35% of the car and 65% of it is produced elsewhere. The suppliers are graded. There's first tier suppliers, second tier suppliers, third tier suppliers. If you go up to Halewood, there's 15 or 16 factories being built in close vicinity to Halewood. They are the first tier suppliers and they build stuff that used to get built in Halewood. And it's moved in. It's moved in by a Japanese company who go under the initials of UPI in this country, but it's actually Nippon Yusen Kaizan or something like that, NYK, which is a shipping and logistics company. They have 150 workers in Halewood, and they move all the, everything that gets made that's got to go in, they move it in. And it's a just-in-time delivery, just-in-time production system. So tyres come from Pirelli in Italy, they're put together close to Halewood into a unit, and then they're shipped into Halewood. So they arrive every 8 hours from Italy, and they go into the factory, and they're only allowed to have 2 hours stock on the line. So it's a just-in-time system, and it's that applies to all the suppliers. And there's a couple of thousand parts in the car, so it's a very complex system, and it's globalised. The parts come from all over the world. Third and second tier companies supply up and onto the first tier suppliers. Now, these people are doing work that was done in Halewood. It's not on the same rate of pay they're getting in Halewood, so it's cheaper to do it this way, to break it up and move it out, subcontracting. It's a system which seems to be invincible in some ways. It's, but I look at it this way. What we've got, and Tony Navy uses this term, but I reckon I used it before him, so I'll soon. The factory without walls. In order to understand how labour power is organised there, we have to think about the factory without walls. And I use that term because the discipline of the factory has been spread throughout the supply chains of global capital. So the logistics companies have to keep to the time that the workers in the factory. They've changed the economy. So you've got, in capitalist terms, it was regarded as a push economy. That is, you push your product through your supply chain to forecasted demand. And I regard it as a pull economy. You only make it if it's been sold. And so you have to have a system that can cope with the demand, go up and down. That's why you've got agency workers, because it's easier to get rid of them when demand goes down. And that applies right through the system. You can't deliver to Ford's, or any other company for that matter, who has those sorts of systems, unless you do it in a particular time. You might have a 2 hour slot. If you deliver before that or after, you've got a problem. Your company's got a problem. The whole system is geared to that factory, to that original equipment manufacturer, but it spreads across the globe. And to me, that makes it an incredibly vulnerable system. It's a bit like the old wagon trains and the cowboy movies. They're stretched out. You hit them there, you hit them there, you're going to cause a problem. And it's been done. I'll move slightly away from Ford. A few years ago, in the States, I've been studying logistics and supply chains now for about 15 years, and it fascinates me. But I'm a sad sod. on the west coast of America, the transport workers are self-employed. happened during the Reagan era. And the truck drivers that removed containers from the docks and delivered them to wherever are self-employed. And because they're self-employed, if they come together, that's regarded as a cartel. And under American law, it's illegal. You can't have cartels. So Ford and General Motors couldn't get together. Be a cartel. So you've got these individual guys who are from Central America, basically. They've come up during the wars, and all those wars have gone on in the 60s and 70s, and have come to the States. They're the guys who run these trucks. And they wanted to join the union. The Teamsters backed off. The ILWU backed away from them. So they started forming like community groups. The El Salvadorian Weekend Club or something. In order to start coming together. But they still wanted to be a union. So they went on strike about 4 years ago. And they closed down the west coast of the United States of America. All the ports. There's thousands of these guys, because you get container ships now that can carry up to 12,000 containers, so you need a lot of lorries. They won't all go by road, but a lot of it will go by road. And these guys have to queue up and wait in a big long queue, get a container. They might take it 200 miles and get a bit of money if they can pick an empty one up and come back. Like, anyway, they went on strike and they closed down the west coast of America. Within days, Walmart, big companies were running out of stock. They were screaming like stuck pigs because they operate a just-in-time supply and production system, so they don't have the inventories. Warehousing today is cross-docking. It's in and out. They're highly automated. So they don't carry a lot of stuff because inventory costs money. It takes up space, therefore it costs money. So I think if we're to fight the Ford Motor Companies of today, then we have to fight across the supply chains. We have to go international. If you read logistics gurus, they say that workers have got to start thinking process and not factory, or don't think you work for the dock company, don't think dock company. I work in the car factory, don't think car factory. Think process. You are part of a global supply chain, think global. I think, great, fine, yeah. Only we'll call it internationalism, we won't call it globalisation. And we'll organise along those supply chains and start to build. It's going to take a time, it's going to be hard work, but I believe that's the way we move forward. Yeah.
On our terms.
Yeah.
Not theirs.
Yeah, on our terms, and we do it at the level we're at. Not because someone up there goes, I know we're going to do this. Because, you know, the way I look at it, I don't believe hierarchical organisations can create an egalitarian society. There's a contradiction there, and it's not going to go away. We have to do it ourselves. Right. I'm just going to flip back slightly, because one of the problems of getting over that and building like that is highlighted at Halewood. When they decided to make the Jaguars there, that's a shame. We were the worst car factory in the world, according to the Economist magazine. And did you know that tells the truth? Who's going to argue with the Economist? Obviously, that wasn't a factory that you'd want to build quality Jaguars in. And they've been planning for a long time. They'd sent a team in on the slide, and they were, hey, it would, 10 of them, for 2.5 years. Looking at what hell was, what was wrong, what went to be right. Studying the whole place for 2.5 years. And they'd obviously been thinking about it before they sent the team in, so they might have been thinking about it maybe 3 or 4 years. And they discovered that it was fucking awful. Excuse my Latin. So they decided they had to do something about the attitude of the workers. Because through the 80s, they tried Japanese systems, and it worked for a bit, and then the workers said, oh, sod this, and it'd go back to the way it was. So what they did, they employed a company called Sendelaney. You might have come across them, maybe not. They're an American company from Los Angeles, but they're tied into a company whose name I can't remember, in Boston, Massachusetts. Sendelaney have now got a base here in this country. They've done work at John Moores University in Liverpool. But Harewood was their big in to this country. And what they are, they fuck with your head. They're there to change your mindset. So again, hand the man from Sendelaney and your section 2, line 1. And you produce crap. Right? You come in late, you'll walk out at the drop of a hat. Well, we're gonna change that. We've got to realise that we're in it together. Maybe that slogan lately. So what they started doing was pairing up managers, high-level managers, with line workers, buddy-buddy system. So they go out for a drink and become mates. And we're having a christening on Sunday, John. Come along. And John would go along to the house of the financial chief of Harewood and drink champers and wet the baby's head. And they become mates and friends. There. This is what they were doing all across the factory. They were still finding problems. So what they decided, we'd pinpoint about half a dozen areas and we'll work on those areas and we'll change them. So they got them into seminar groups and they were talking to them. They were convincing them that this was the right way to go about it, that we're all in it together. It's your company as well as ours. And then they sold it. And then they used those sections that had bought it to become mentors and put them into other sections and get them to change. And they changed the mindset. Except 300 guys, they have to sign individual contracts. And 300 guys said, you can shove it. We ain't doing it. We're leaving. And they left. But the rest are still there, 2,000. And it's killer. Right? It's an absolute killer. Because I bumped into a guy a couple of years ago, I was his shop steward. We didn't get on, we come to blows. He was in the Orange Lodge. There's quite a lot of Orange Lodge in Liverpool because, well, it's an Irish city, right? I'm walking down the road, this guy's coming towards me, and I thought, oh shit, is he going to throw another punch? I hadn't seen him in years. So, yeah. Brian Ashton, man. All right, Bob. How you doing? He grabbed my hands and he shook my hand off. He said, I never agreed with you, he said, but you were right. He said, I've got out. He said, they're grinding us into the ground with this Jaguar stuff. He said, they just want more and more and more. He said, our kid's still in there. He's had 2 nervous breakdowns, but he won't leave because he's got 2 girls still at school. He said, but the strain of it is incredible, because what they've done, if you went back to our day, you had janitors, you had repairmen, so when you put anybody doing the job, you let a bit of it go, they pick it up, and they do your reliefs, your toilet reliefs. They're taking all that out and then putting it into the teams, and the team has to do everything, basically, and then they sit down and talk about how they can do it better and faster, and it's just that constant pressure with that system, and you tie to the speed of the automated areas, because they're a lot of the body plants are automated. The PTA is very difficult to automate because it's about nuts and bolts and screws, but they've broken it up a lot. What you get now, we used to fit the looms, the wiring that makes the electrics. So you have a main loom and behind the dashboard. Then the dashboard gets fitted with the clocks and 2 lines on. Go 3 lines on from that and you get the steering wheels sub-assembled on site and then fitted in the car. But now, you've got all the wiring, all the dashboard, clocks and the steering wheel for 1 unit made somewhere else. And it comes in the car, bump, 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 it's bolted in and done. So you don't need as many people, obviously, because the work's being done elsewhere, and the pace of it is incredible, and it's burnout. And I know a number of other guys have worked there, and guy used to tell me to work, said the same, he was there so a couple of years ago, and he said, they just keep asking, they want more, and more, and more. He said, I'm 58, he said, I can't do it anymore, so I've got out. And so that's what you get with companies like Senderlane. You turn your head and then you get screwed even more for it. So we've got a situation, I think, we as a working class, we've got to come to terms with this system, see how it works, how the supply chains of capital work, and how do we link up along them. Because if we don't, I think we're going to get the shit kicked out for a long time until we actually address those issues and build new links, new organisation, but not national, not European, but global, because these companies build global, they operate global, and they're giving us the opportunity because we've changed the transport industry to accommodate, to work for them. We've changed the communications industry to work for them. We've got computers, we've got email, we can go global with it, and we don't need to go through union bureaucrats, we don't need to go through conveners committees who are tied into the company. We can do it, and we have to do it. I think it's imperative that this is how we start to work. I'll finish there, really. I don't, because I know.
That's what really screwed the combine in the end, is that, like, as things sort of went, it got kind of more and more kind of sucked into the, like, making contacts with official union people. I mean, there was a conference in 1985 in Liverpool, right, by which time I'd left, but I went up and I managed to wheedle my way in to go and photograph it. And it was like people from all over the world. United Auto Workers of America, you know, had sort of Philippines, you know, people from the Philippines, people from Japan, people from Brazil. It was financed partly because the GLC at the time was kind of had a lot of radicals in it, and they put some money into it. And also you had the sort of weirdo militant Liverpool City Council. In fact, I remember, like, they were, all the delegates were welcomed by Degsy.
Derek Hatton for those who don't know.
A sort of, I don't know what he is, he's sort of champagne socialist of sorts, isn't he?
He's a private property developer, he's got properties in Cyprus, and he owns a new stack of land just next to the main railway station, which he sold off.
Wish I'd joined Milton now.
What happened with this conference is you suddenly became aware of what you were really up against. Because on the one hand, you had these people from, like, you know, the factories in Brazil who were members of Lula's Workers' Party, really solid, you know, really good people, you know. And, like, you had people from sort of kind of Malaysia, really good guy. You know, and then you had these guys from the American Auto Workers, you know, Auto Workers Union, and you think, what are these guys on about? You know, they're talking about, like, all their kind of big deals that they had going with the management and stuff. The guy from Japan was in a management union, you know, it was kind of like corporate union, you know, like how well they all got on. I mean, it was really weird, you know? I mean, you know, it was like you suddenly realised that you cannot, you know, that you have to organise internationally, but that can't be, I mean, this was before internet as well, but you can't, it has to be sort of done through somehow, I don't know, we have to find ways of sort of doing it through the rank and file, you know. I mean, if only the IWW was a bigger organisation, I mean, as it was in the 20s in America, I mean, it's just small, tiny thing. But, you know, that's the model that I would like to see going, or something like, you know, CNT in Spain or something, or I don't know what it's called, so the International Workers Association or something. I mean, those kind of networks that work. I've got one funny story, though. Can I say it? Which is that it's just a little another anecdote, is that, like, in the KD, which is where they crated up the engines.
KD stands for knockdown, by the way.
Right, we basically sort of kind of like, we discovered that the engines were going to South Africa. But like, you know, at the time it was apartheid. And so we sort of kind of thought, well, you know, get some bloody leaflets in there. So we sort of got all these leaflets put into the crates with the engines, you know. Wonderful workers in sort of dagging them to sort of, you know, like, you know, the thought workers in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, you know. Anyway, at this conference in 1985, there is a man called Dan Peters, right, from the equivalent KD in Port Elizabeth. And I got talking to him, you know, sort of like, you know. And I said, did you by any chance ever get any leaflets when you were opening up the crowd? Yeah. And I said, did it have a fraud symbol? Yeah, it all was fraud. It was fraud.
Anyway,
some questions at the back end.
Sorry.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about the people, the truck drivers in America and their successful strike. And what
how did they organise? Well, they had unofficial organisations, which they called community groups.
Some of them were Wobblies, actually.
Yeah, and the Wobblies were involved. I wouldn't say they were successful, because they never got union recognition, yeah. But it made the unions who weren't supporting them, like the ILWU and the Teamsters, realise that this is a potential for them, potential recruitment ground, right? And if I'll have one after.
What do you want?
Well, there's no way available.
It's not as cold as the new.
Yeah, I'll give them this, mate. Give them this. Don't get drunk or get drunk on proper stuff. So they've started to make overtures to them. But they're still unable to form a union. But that's not the first dispute they've had. I'm sure there'll be others, because they're not self-employed. In order to get the work, they have to get the work off an agent.
Yeah.
So if the agent don't give them no work, they ain't got no work. So it's not as if they could go out and get it themselves.
Yeah, of course.
But the law as it stands prevents it from happening. But I think what they showed was how vulnerable that system is of just-in-time production and just-in-time delivery. It is really easy to hit, I think. And if you organise across a couple of countries, you can... And they're aware of it. Capital's aware of it. If you go to the States, General Motors have what they call a war office. And they employ, I think it's 8 or 10 people whose job is to know everything that's happening in the world that will impact upon General Motors, right? So if there's a typhoon off the southeast China coast, which is going to hold up the shipments, we'll say, of alternators going to the States, means it's going to be running 6 hours late, might be able to make that time up. Then they have to source alternators from somewhere else. So their job is to see that. Or the area of a strike in Mexico where they make batteries, shall we say. They have to know that straight away. That's their job. And they call it the war office, because it is war. It's class war, right? But that's what they do. They know their own systems are vulnerable, but they're tied into a situation, really, aren't they? Because they... The only way they can overcome it is to come back and operate in the States, and they can't afford to do that because of the race level.
Yeah, so what I know about is aeroplanes, and a very, very interesting thing happened with Boeing. They've just built this new airliner called the 787, the Dreamliner, which you might have heard some propaganda about. But it's a new kind of aeroplane, it's new materials and that, and to try and deal with their problem of particularly machinists in Seattle. There's like sort of 40,000-50,000 machinists, and they've historically gone on strike. In fact, they were on strike a couple of years ago during the 787. But to get around that problem, they did exactly what you've been talking about, which is not just globalising, but really spreading the supply chain out, so that not only, you know, you've still got a problem. For example, if you took one bit of your factory out to, right, or subcontract to another factory, if there's still a concentration of workers there, that could still be a problem if it's just sole supply. If they go on strike, you know, like you said, it's screwed. So one of the theories was that the more you distribute the spread the chain out, the more you make smaller enterprises that are linked to second, third, fourth, fifth tier connections. So that would make you safer. But in practice, they actually had severe problems with that. Because the more they spread the chain out, they realised they needed to have multiple suppliers, which made it even more complicated because they couldn't rely on one. So multiple suppliers, and there were still strikes going in different places. And the whole aeroplane is like 2.5 years late now because of that desperate attempt to spread the supply chain out. Now they've actually said they're not going to do that again. So they're actually withdrawing a little bit from that. The strikes were going on because all the work was going out to Seattle and Wichita, where they made it in the States, and it's been spread all over the world, and there was a big fight by the, you know, obviously, workers in those plants to try and retain work. And whilst in the middle of all this chaos, 35,000 machinists went on strike as well, even though they were kind of at the wrong end, it was sort of the Seattle end. So I would say they've got problems with this. It's not like all running really smoothly or anything like that. Major projects have still really got this problem of how much you spread it out and how much you concentrate the work.
It seems to me that one of the major problems for capitalism, well, one of the major problems for people trying to change it, is the fantastic low wages in Indonesia, China, and India, and places like that. And that means that, first of all, these people are nearly breadline, and secondly, it has some effect on people like in the metropolitan centres trying to do anything. The work is just moved up. So I'm interested to know, you know, what, how that fits into what you're saying.
Well, there's a guy coming up to speak here shortly. Marco, come on. We could if Marco was actually here now. Marco worked in India. Lived and worked in India. Worked in call centre work. And lived in an area called Gurgaon. I think that's the right pronunciation. Which is a suburb of Delhi. But it's not like any suburb we know. There are millions and millions of people living in this suburb. And you've got high-tech companies, state-of-the-art factories, all the major multinationals. But around them, you have what I could only describe as 19th century British housing, working class housing conditions. And they live and work in those situations. But they're fighting, they're struggling, there's strikes all the time. China's the same. If you look, in the last year, there's been a lot of struggles in China,
Bangladesh,
Vietnam, which. So they've run away, but what they've found is that when you create a working class, you get the problems that come with a working class. And so the struggle is going on over there. The problem is to link it, but the struggle is there, and they're aware of what's they're aware they're being exploited. Even when it's green labour again, they're bringing green labour in India from the land, they become radicalised within the workplace. I mean, Beverly Silver did a book on it a few years ago. What was it called?
Forces of Labour.
Forces of Labour. I read it, but I can't never remember the title. Where she looks, where Ford's factories, that type of factory, gets built, it produces radicalism within the workers. They become militant, no matter where it is. It's just that. That's why they changed it to Toyota system. This just-in-time production. But even if you look at that, if you go back in 1945, the end of the Second World War, Japanese capital wouldn't open the factories. The workers went in and occupied them and opened the factories. In 1947, there was a massive lockout in Japan and the Japanese working class were defeated. I believe that's where the Toyota system come from. Because they had a defeated working class, they were unable to build that system and the workers couldn't resist it. And it's been... And then when the Fordist system broke down, that's what they've seen as the system to employ. So it's a Toyota's teamwork type system. But whatever they put that, as they're shown in India and as they're shown in China and the country we've mentioned, you're getting a militant working class who's saying no. Not that little. the best word, you know, you ever see anyone, they say, what's your favourite word? My favourite word is no. It's a wonderful word, only two letters, but it scares the crap out of them. And that's what workers in India started to do, Bangladesh, Pakistan. And in fact, a few years ago, there was some talk that some of the major American companies were going to come closer to home because of the problems they had. Let's ship it to Mexico, but you get stronger than Mexico. We are a troublemaking class, wherever we are. But
you might trouble when you was in the army.
A little bit, yes. I declared myself a communist while I was in the army. I was in jail. Don't go on strike in the army. You don't like it. That's what I found. Because I went on strike while I was in there as well. So, you know, I think, to go back, it's there, it's out there. The connections have got to be made. We've got to make the connections and they've got to make the connections. But it's there, the potential to link up and take them on and win. You know, we've had too many years where we've maybe been losing things, but I think that's because we're dominated by the unions, and the unions have a way of thinking, and it's through bureaucracies, and we meet up internationally, but it'll be the guy in the grey suit, it won't be the guy in the overalls or the woman in the overalls, it'll be the bosses of the union. We've got to go at it differently.
Yeah, I'd say, as people that produce miracles for, people to drive, I used to be a professional driver about 6 months ago. So it's like if you're driving, cars and trucks and, public transport vehicles for a living, the rules and regulations, regards to, working hours, how many times you can take out, how many hours you can spend on the road driving, because obviously you don't want to fall asleep at the wheel and cause a pile up on the motorway. And that, just trying to get me head around this sort of division between the people that actually produce the vehicles and the people that actually drive the vehicles. I'm a TNG member, the rules and regulations that regard health and safety with, hours that you're sort of on the road. And, so I can't understand why there isn't any sort of, sympathy or sort of, compassion between product users and product producers. Wondering how much that you think that the breakdown of working class communities about to do with that, because if you lived on a council estate, you might be a truck driver, your missus, without being sexist, might be a cleaner, but that's, and there's loads of women bus drivers there, fantastic, but just wondering, just coming out of this sort of the workplace scenario and just sort of moving back into the community again,
It's all down to reserve pool of labour, isn't it, and our contractual status. I mean, I'm dealing with drivers at the moment. They turn up in the morning, and there's some ropey lorry there with sort of the wheels are 3/4 pumps up. They've got 2 tonnes extra on the back of the load, and if they get fucking nicked, they'll nick them, not the company. And if they don't like it, they get someone else to drive it. That's one of the worst things I see with lorry drivers. There's loads of unregulated lorries driving around our cities and motorways every bleeding day because of scum proprietors who send them out in all shapes of disrepair. And this goes back to it, doesn't it? At the end of the day, I do a lot of work with local government. The amount of 0 hours contracts, stuff like that, Lecturers, I know people who lecture in universities or what have you, the actual relationship if you like, with an employer is completely different. You know, it's all that, it's all hands off, subcontracting, a lot of people are self-employed, SC60, a bit here, a bit there, you know, and you've got nobody to turn to. And another side of that as well is the collective bargaining. You know, I mean, what I heard today about Dagenham's, I mean, I remember as a little boy Dagenham's, I mean, Fords at Dagenham, it was like a little city in its own right, you know what I mean? It's very rare to see things like that nowadays, you know. And that is one of the issues, you know. It's about how we collectively work together and understand our individual struggles.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
I think there's a difference in terms of.
And can I just point out that this is the donation wobbly hat, and please pass around and fill your boots.